We've been doing a number of stories about the trade in exotic or almost extinct species. We spoke last month, for instance, to John Scanlon from that big CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, about precisely this. Well, now I'm bringing you the story of the world's most coveted aquarium fish, the Asian arowana. Rumour has it one specimen sold for $150,000. And because it throws such light on attitudes in Southeast Asia, we just thought it was really interesting to hear about. My last guest today, the American science and culture journalist Emily Voigt, ventured into the rather murky waters where theft is common, as well as a love of the arowana, otherwise known as the dragonfish. She travelled the world in search of not the dragonfish in a glass tank, but the real deal. And she starts her book, The Dragon Behind the Glass, with the murder of a Malaysian owner of an aquarium shop in Taiping, who was murdered in 2004 for his 20 dragonfish. Emily, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me.
And congratulations for allowing yourself to become so obsessed with this by your own confession.
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, it really was an obsession, one that I didn't necessarily see coming.
No, yeah. So that's what you said. Why such interest? I mean, why does this type of fish drive people to murder?
Right. So that was the question that I started with. I myself didn't have a particular interest in fish at the time. I had never kept pet fish, so to speak. And it seemed crazy to me, frankly, that aquarists were willing to take such inordinate risks just to own the fish. You know, here in the United States, as in Australia, it's illegal to bring the species across the border. So I was hearing stories about, you know, Wall Street bankers who had broken down in tears after their illegal pet fish was confiscated. And I thought, well, what's going on here? What would drive people to such extremes?
Yes. Before we get into the detail, I just think so that listeners understand the context, particularly in the US, the aquarium trade moves a greater number of species, more than 7,000, than any other industry. There are more exotic animals in American households than in American zoos. And fish, I think, which a lot of people would think, fish just play a crucial role in this, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. This was a larger picture that I was completely unaware of when I first started reporting on the illegal wildlife trade in New York. I didn't realize that the United States was one of the largest markets in the world for endangered species, but indeed it is. And when we're talking exotic pets, fish really represent the majority of those. They're our last wild pets in a way, along with reptiles and amphibians.
And particularly for men, yeah. You say, particularly for men.
Right, right. That's right. It is a male-dominated hobby, aquarium keeping, traditionally so. And the arowana, especially so. This is a machismo fish, a macho fish. So I was really entering a world in which I you know, stuck out like a sore thumb. I didn't seem to belong.
I assume the fish has been around for a long time, but is this desire to own a dragonfish something that is quite recent?
Well, the fish itself dates back to the age of the dinosaurs. It has been on the earth for a very long time, relatively unchanged, which is part of what makes it so intriguing as an animal. And you know, when I first dug into this story, I expected to find that it had this deep history in Asian cultures. But in fact, it's a relatively new phenomenon, the idea of the dragonfish. People really started keeping it in large numbers in the 1980s. And so my question then became, why? What had happened? Before that, they were really eating it. It was a food fish in the swamp, and it wasn't even a particularly good one. It wasn't really what you wanted to have for dinner. It was just what was on the table. And now, of course, it's commanding these exorbitant prices, much like the art market.
Can you describe the fish to us, please? Is it marvelous to look at?
Sure. Well, I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder, or in the mind of the beholder, according to the biologist E.O. Wilson. But yeah, a lot of people are listening to this and probably picturing something like a guppy or a goldfish, a small fish, because that's what we think of as pet fish usually. But this thing is really large. In the wild, it can grow 3 feet long. So we're talking something the size of a samurai sword, I write in the book. And it has these large scales. They're very round, like coins. And the fish is kind of plated in a sort of armor It's said to look like the Chinese dragon, which is where some of the beliefs around its being an auspicious fish, a lucky fish that will bring good fortune and prosperity, kind of arise from this association with the dragon. It has these little whiskers that jut from its chin.
And it's got this long bony tongue, you say.
Yeah, right. It's called the Asian bony tongue. That's its formal name. It's named for the fact that it has a bone of a tongue that it uses to grab prey. So it will actually leap out of the water many feet and seize prey from low-hanging branches.
And it becomes very loyal to its owner, or it can, like a dog, and it can be very bad-tempered. It's all sort of rather funny in a way, but it's certainly not funny, the modern fascination with it, which is where it can become very serious business, isn't it? I should say it's naturally found from sort of southern Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, in that whole Southeast Asia area, isn't it, in the islands of Sumatra and Borneo.
Yeah, that's right. There's different color varieties that come from different little micro regions, but the fish itself has a relatively wide distribution throughout Southeast Asia.
Hmm. Now, you've visited some of the dragon fish farms in Asia where there's almost mafia-style patrols of the farms concerned, where people have been abducted and certainly robbed. And is this because of the huge amounts of money involved?
Yes. On the one hand, yes, it's because the fish is valuable and it's easy money in a sense. You can steal the babies and sell them on the black market. But also, I think there's sort of like a black market allure to the fish. For many years, it was the trade was prohibited. It was on a list of endangered species that's protected internationally, banned from international trade. So this kind of got it tied up with the Japanese Yakuza, for example, the Japanese mafia. And that gave the fish sort of a sheen of danger, I think. And so, there were a lot of rumors. There was this spate of fish thefts that had been sweeping the region and the farms. Some of them, they look like prisons. They have nested concrete walls and guard dogs prowling the perimeter and watchtowers, all for a fish that's inside.
And so is it about status? Like, I see Japan was the largest market for dragonfish until recently when China's supplanted it. Because is it this symbol of upward mobility or something?
Absolutely. It is an aspirational fish. I don't know how else to put it. It is a fish that, you know, they don't all cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Those are kind of the super record prices, right? Most people buy them for a few thousand dollars when they're young, about the size of a finger, and then they rear them for years into a full-grown dragonfish. And it's kind of a sign of, you know, of having wealth. It's a sign of prestige. And very much so. It's been likened very often to car collecting. So the Super Red, which is one of the most coveted varieties from the heart of Borneo, is known as the Ferrari of fishes.
The Ferrari of fishes. And you quote Edward O. Wilson, the great writer, in a marvellous quote at the start of your book, "The truth is that we never conquered the world, never understood it. We only think we have control. We do not even know why we respond a certain way to other organisms and need them in diverse ways so deeply." You must have included that quote for a very important reason. You must have drawn some conclusions about this trade stroke obsession.
Yeah, I mean, just hearing you read it, it still gives me chills. What a beautiful,
fabulous, isn't it?
Yeah. What a beautiful passage. But right, to me, it's a great mystery. Why do we put a fish in a tank? Right? Is it just pure materialism? Is it a desire to understand the other? You know, when we look in the eyes of a fish, it's kind of like looking at a being that is at once relatable, but as far as possible away from us on the spectrum of relatability. You know, there's something quite distant about it and unbridgeable about the piscine mind, the mind of a fish. And I think that there's curiosity, right? But in a larger sense, why do human beings meddle with everything? Why can we not leave anything in the natural world alone? This kind of urge for exploration, for understanding, and it has a positive side to it that I write about. Even in the aquarium hobby, I write about how much respect I have for some of these diehard aquarists who really know the scientific names of things, who understand how the natural world fits together, the evolutionary lineage of various fish, and you know what's happening to them today, something that most of us are terribly unaware of. But you know, and then there's the other side of it, is like having to have the hot new thing and having to exert dominion over other creatures. And just the question of dominion to me was a central one. What is our responsibility to other living creatures?
Yes, I'm going to come to that in just a moment, because this whole discussion about whether they're in the wild or whether it's legal to farm the fish becomes important. But just as an aside, you make the point about this question of dominion. You quote the Brazilian story, which I didn't know, that and you can tell us properly, where the Brazilian government has absolutely put a whole group of uncontacted peoples totally, totally off limits. No one, not even scientists, are allowed to go there. And the reason is to preserve it.
That's right. The Javari Valley, it's an area of Brazil that is entirely off limits, essentially. It's where the most uncontacted tribes in the world live. You know, this came up because I don't want to give away anything in the book, but I never pictured myself stumbling into uncontacted Indians. But I will say that this fish has taken me to places I could not have imagined. But in any case, yeah, right. The idea was that originally benign contact was what the Brazilian government encouraged. This would end up in ruin, inevitably, for isolated peoples.
And the species, I might add.
Yeah, right, exactly. So the question is, does that same model apply to species? Do we need to rope them off and say, hands off everybody? Mm-hmm. You know, like no scientists allowed in there, no anthropologists in the case of people, but can we escape our own nature in a sense? Are we able to
stand back and be restrained?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It was, and that, you know, the belief was anyway that particular area in Brazil, forcibly maintained, has actually got this extraordinary number of species thriving. I don't even know whether we fully know. It's just a very interesting sidebar. So let's get to this question then. This wild fish, the arowana, it is a protected species, but it's legal to farm the fish, isn't it, and to sell them, which the conservationists
yes.
don't like at all.
Right. I call it a mass-produced endangered species, which is, a modern paradox. It's not something I would have expected to find. I mean, they're bred by the hundreds of thousands each year, and there are very, very few left in the wild, which is why they're endangered. The question of whether it's appropriate or helpful to commercially breed endangered species is a big one.
Why don't the conservationists like it?
It's interesting. There's two problems. One is laundering. So you take a fish out of the wild and then you say you bred it on your farm, right? And certainly that happens in these kinds of models. But the other problem, which may be even bigger, is that it creates a market or expands a market that wasn't there in the first place. So this fish was really hot in the 80s and even the 90s. But then this international farming program was established to help benefit the fish, that's when I noticed this huge spike in fish thefts and, the murder that you talked about that I opened the book with, which is just a terrible, horrible story. It's a case of a fish really being valued more highly than a human life. That happened in the wake of this farming program. So it is an interesting quandary about whether we can safely commodify a species and still protect it in the wild.
So what conclusion did you draw? Because you really wrestle with this about whether human dominion ultimately can be for the good or not, and particularly sort of regulation.
Right. I went to some dark places, I'll say that. But I do feel like our best intentions, as I write, can go horribly wrong. But I hope that we can also learn from what's happened to the fish, and also there is something wonderful about our desire to understand nature and even to protect it. There's something deep within us that wants to connect with wild things, that wants to preserve them. And I have to hope that that wins out.
All right, Emily Voigt, on that hopeful note, constructive note, I'll thank you very much for your time and congratulations on all of this work.
Oh, thank you so much, Geraldine. I really appreciate it. It was great fun.
Emily Voigt, V-O-I-G-T, and her book is The Dragon Behind the Glass, a true story of power, obsession, and the world's most coveted fish. It's a Simon & Schuster publication.